Hello and welcome back to the social.
This summer, the Office of Sustainability is focusing our sustainable spotlight on people that are doing good sustainable work around the Charleston community. You can join us for more podcasts at synergies.cfc.edu. Welcome again to the Sustainability Spotlight Podcast at the Office of Sustainability. I'm Tanner and I'm here with Emma, and today we will be interviewing Dr. Hollis France. Dr. France is a political science professor, a member of the Latin American and Caribbean Studies Program and the Women and Gender Studies Program at the College of Charleston. She is also the director of the Gender and Sexuality Equity Center at the college, which is what we'll be focusing on today. So if you want to start, introducing yourself and talking about what you do at the college.
Okay. Some other interesting things about myself is that I was born in Guyana in South America. I've been here at the college for 18 years. In terms of my research focus, as a political scientist, I focus a lot on international and comparative politics. And then as you borrow a little deeper below that, I do a lot of political economy. I'm looking at that political economy and the intersections with gender. And also, like, shifted my research focus to looking at particularly interested in indigenous epistemologies, and that's basically in terms of knowledges. Mm-hmm. And really kind of indigenous knowledges around issues like development, and looking at how indigenous knowledges about development really differ from these Western mainstream knowledges about development. So that's where, in terms of my research, really is centered. And as also, as you pointed out, the director of the Gender and Sexuality Equity Center here at the College of Charleston.
So, like, what brought you to the college?
So this was in terms of my first job. So I'd come down, actually, which is really interesting too, in 2008, my daughter's dad was here, and so we were seeing each other, and I came down to the to Charleston, and it's like I was actually writing up my dissertation. So at that point you could be anywhere writing up, and then it's like, oh, I think I'll move to Charleston, and decided, hey, let me reach out. I guess I should be teaching or doing some agile thing. I mean, I had a full ride in terms of fellowship, so I really didn't need money. I could be anywhere in the government. But I said it would be nice in terms of thinking about going into academia. And I reached out to the College of to the political science department, and they were like, do you want an adjunct? And so I was doing a class for political science and a class for Latin American Caribbean studies. And then after that, I don't know, they were like, do you want to do like four classes? Do you want to be an instructor? And then after, I got like, would you be interested in a visiting line? And I'm like, okay. Then a position came open in political science, and they asked me if I would be interested in applying for it, and I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a no-brainer. Cool. And that's how I applied. And then, so by 2002, I became an assistant professor.
Why, like, what inspired, like, your interest in, like, political and, like, social issues? Because it seems like that's where all your work is.
Yeah. I think from a very young age, and especially growing up in Guyana, in South America, and growing up in a household, where my mom was a university professor, and, so she'd have, like, other academics, and they'd come out and they'd be, I remember, like, at 7 years old, and I'm sitting in the living room, and I'm hearing about bourgeoisie and petty bourgeoisie, and they're just like, having all of these debates about the merits of Marxism and so forth. So, you kind of, as a child, you're kind of listening to those things. But then I think that the big thing also growing up in what we call kind of a developing country, or, you know, the term third world country, right? And where things, at the time I wasn't aware of it, but things like structural adjustment that hit with IMF and World Bank policies, and not recognizing why as a kid, for example, there were certain things that I couldn't get any longer that weren't being imported. I could understand that as a kid. But then you heard the rhetoric, especially in terms of the political rhetoric, of why these things were happening, and it was kind of blamed, right, on the Western imperialists and so forth, right? So you, I think you always kind of grew up with a lot of people within the Caribbean, right? So other guys in South America, we share more of a cultural affiliation with the English-speaking Caribbean, right? So in terms of the a lot of people in the Caribbean, I think coming from developing countries, you're always kind of aware of how you're, you know, always on that periphery, or you're in the shadow, right, mm-hmm. of these Western, you know, industrialized countries, right? So, I think as a time, you know, then you go on to college, you know, you start to kind of study, kind of open up, right, to some of the critical development theoretical stuff that people are writing, right? And they're talking mm-hmm. about why it is that, you know, developing countries remain underdeveloped, right? So you have to understand structurally what's going on globally, right? And the power dynamics. So I think kind of coming out of my childhood and coming out of where I came, the country that I came from, that's what really kind of got me interested. And I think ultimately what I'm interested in, again, is this issue of power. Right? And it's about dynamics, the power dynamics.
Right? We talked about that in my first podcast. It was all about power dynamics. Yeah. I like that.
What was your mom, what did she teach?
She was a professor of education.
Of education.
Yeah.
So. It's interesting that she was a professor in that more.
Yeah. Like, and I think, you know, and I think for me also in terms of like the kind of feminist part of it too, you know, and my mother, she's pretty powerful. She's much more brilliant than I am. She also, it was also to see her in a room, she dominated with men, right? Because she was that powerful, and mm-hmm. they would sit and they would listen to her. Mm-hmm. You know, part of it, as a little girl, you're just like, oh my God. Yeah. Like, they're listening to her, and this is like really serious. And, you know, they'd come to our house, and my dad was like, oh, Lynette is in there, her and her colleagues, you know. And he, you know, so my dad was more kind of hands-on with the kids, making sure we did the homework.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. And my mom was like, you know, the typical university professor. You know, she was doing her classes, and then she was into bridge. So we used to call ourselves bridge orphans because, you know, she'd have her friends over, and then, you know, you'd walk up and you're like, oh, they're playing bridge, you know, that kind of thing. But I think that also, you know, she inspired me, you know, as a kind of as a woman too, mm-hmm. you know, that, you know, we are brilliant, we are smart, and we do have something to say, mm-hmm. you know, and it's not, you know, academia or whatever, it's not the domain of just me.
So what exactly does the Gender and Sexual Equity Center do on campus?
So GSEC, I like to think about, I mean, one of the things is in terms of thinking about GSEC is kind of set up as something that was kind of a resource center, right? Mm-hmm. And it's there to serve in terms of faculty, staff, and students, right? So it's not just in terms of, a lot of people think of programs on campus as just geared towards students, but this is in terms of the entire campus community that we're focused on. Our ultimate, in terms of mission, is to really institutionalize gender equity on campus. And there are two ways that I look at it in terms of how we attempt to do that. So on one hand is through programs, and the other hand, we do policy reviews. So in terms of thinking of some of the programmatic aspect of that, for example, we do a Start Smart Negotiation Salary Workshop, and we do that at one every single semester. And that basically is trying to particularly focusing on young women as they're coming into the workforce, you know, addressing things like the one gender wage gap and making sure that young women know as they go into the workforce, you know, what they're worth. And I often tell students, I wish that I'd had that when I was in college. Because I think even, you know, as I got my first job here at the College of Charleston, perhaps I might have been able to negotiate a higher salary. But again, a lot of times, you know, how women have been kind of trained, you know, that, you know, you don't kind of rock the boat, you know, you don't want to be seen as pushy. And it's also open to males, right? Because I think it's also important that they understand how this gender wage gap operates to continue to reproduce inequalities in the workforce. So that, you know, that's one example. We have a gender equity week that we do in the spring. And, you know, that's a really great way to kind of highlight some of the good work that's already been done on campus, because we try to bring folks from different programs, different disciplines, you know, to put on something, right, that reflects in terms of, you know, gender equity on campus. So it's a really good time to showcase what's been done and also where we also need to go. When it comes to policy reviews on campus, we have done policy reviews, for example, on the sexual misconduct code here on campus, and we're looking particularly at the reporting structure on campus, because you know, some students have been concerned, right? There's not a lot of clarity when it comes to the reporting structure. So the college, for example, had a very mandatory reporting structure, which at the time when we did it, it said it was mandatory. So anybody, as a professor, for example, or, you know, a staff member, somebody went to them and said that, you know, a particular incident happened, we were required to report. And we kind of came to the conclusion that a tiered system might be much more feasible here to the different offices.
So what would a tiered system look like?
So a tiered system would be, for example, that you know, that there's certain people that it's mandatory, right? So dean of students, right? If it gets to that point, the dean of student is basically, they have to take up the case. At the lower tier, if, for example, if they went to a professor, you know, just like the professor, they said, you know, this has happened, I'm not sure that I want to go through in terms of the whole reporting system, right? So that person, that professor can then, you know, give them perhaps, well, if you do decide, here, this is the next step, this is where you go. So in other words, I think what we thought it would be better for the student, right, to be aware of what the process was, because a lot of students are not sure that they want to be in the public eye, right? So kind of because they feel re-victimized all over again. We've also done a audit, LGBTQ audit on campus, and we kind of teamed up with Campus Pride. So Campus Pride is this national organization that looks in terms of colleges, kind of ranking them in terms of how safe, welcoming, inclusive they are of LGBT communities. So we did an audit, and basically what we did is that they sent us a bunch of information for each department program on campus. So like things to do with housing, things to do with campus security, things to do with the policies on campus. You know, for example, do you get the sense that the upper echelons of the administration, like the president and the vice presidents, when they go out to functions or when they're at functions, is there inclusive language, for example, that's being used? Looking at the mission of the college and so forth. So what we did was then we went to all of these departments and we said, look, these are some questions, can you answer this? And we compiled that information, sent it off to Campus Pride. They looked it over and then they did an assessment. So we came out with a 3.5 out of 5 stars. I think we're doing some good things, mm-hmm. and you can go to the Campus Pride website, and we're on there in the College of Charleston. So any potential student that's looking at the College of Charleston, you know, and wants to kind of find out about the LGBT, you know, climate here, mm-hmm. right, could go and see in terms of what are some of the things that we're doing. And I get the sense on campus that people are working towards it. You know, mm-hmm. in other words, it's not a resistance.
Yeah.
Right, which is, you know, a really good space to me for us to be in. You know, as G said, we also gave our input in terms of, okay, so this is what they said, and perhaps these are some of the further steps. And we shared it with all of the folks that were involved in terms of giving us information. And then out of that, the housing folks reached out to us like last summer and asked us if we would do a transgendered housing policy review. So we then were looking at kind of what they call gender neutral housing. And we looked at different universities and colleges. We looked at the language that was being used. We looked at in terms of the different, you know, housing options that were available and so forth. And we came back to the, you know, to the housing folks in particular. We said, here's the what we followed. And as a result of that, one of the things that they have now embarked upon for the fall, for the first time, when housing applications are, when folks are interested in coming to the college, or when they're accepted, they get to kind of fill out their options. You know, one of the things that's really kind of, and I can't remember the direct questions, kind of paraphrasing it, is, you know, would you be open to, you know, sharing a room or a suite with somebody, you know, who identifies as, you know, LGBTQ or something like that. So, and one of the things that I've asked them to do, what would be really interesting, is to collect that data over the years, right, to see in terms of, as folks are coming in, you know, are they open to that? And I think that that data can then be used to perhaps then call for having an entire floor that's gender inclusive, mm-hmm. and then perhaps move on to that to have a dorm, mm-hmm. you know, that's, you know,
that's cool. Because I don't remember who I was talking to, but I think a lot of times people have this concept of College of Charleston. Mm-hmm. They talk about like beaches and King Street and just how, you know, such a nice life you'll have here. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people think in the South especially that it's going to not be quite as LGBTQ friendly. Right.
Yeah.
And so I think that's really awesome that there is, they can see that on, mm-hmm. what is it, Pride?
Yeah, Campus Pride.
Campus Pride.
Yeah.
People can go look at that.
Yeah.
And determine that, oh, well, maybe actually this is more of an inclusive place than I thought.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really funny because we were at a street fair. It was a sustainability street mm-hmm. fair that we were tabling. And I think it was during the course of, potential folks just visiting the college. And there was a college counselor from Washington State. And she just happened, she stopped by. And she saw, you know, mm-hmm. so we were sharing the table with Prism. And so she saw that, and then she's like, gender and sexuality. We started talking. She's like, oh my God, this is so great to know. Because she says, I've had students in my office, you know, thinking about the Southeast, or, you know, or just the East Coast and so forth. And this is really great to be able to share with them. Because, again, the perception is, mm-hmm. especially in the South,
yeah.
you know, and South Carolina,
yeah.
you know, that's conservative all the way. Right. That is not going to be welcoming and inclusive. Mm-hmm. So she was really happy in that sense, to be able to, she took all this material from us. She's like, I'm taking this back with me to be able to share.
Cool. Yeah, Charleston's kind of like a weird little like pocket in the middle of South Carolina. So is there a way for students to get involved with GSEC?
So what we've encouraged is that if, you know, students are interested, we don't have all of the ideas, right, in terms of things that will work towards institutionalizing gender equity, right? So if students, for example, have ideas about a project that they want to do, you know, or they want to do a survey, we're there that we, in terms of being able to support them. Right, and even, you know, there's some, you know, faculty and staff on the GSEC board, we could help to guide them in terms of doing that. We also have, from one time to the other, depending on the semester, we might have 1 to 3 students that are actually part of the GSEC executive committee. They can also kind of give us feedback from the student perspective. The other thing is, in terms of thinking of GSEC as a resource center, you know, I've had students that have reached out to me that are doing projects that center around looking at the intersectionality of race and gender, and they're bringing in a speaker, and they need, you know, support. We get to co-sponsor that. We've had students who've put on like art displays in the library, and have reached out to us, and we've given them in terms of money for that. So.
Sweet. This is kind of going back a little bit, but when did GSEC start?
So GSEC originally started in about 2014.
Okay.
Originally, this kind of came out, the president, President Benson, when he was here, he had a presidential committee, a diversity committee. And part of that diversity committee had a subcommittee on women and gender. There was a student who was on the committee. And it was really about the time also where there were some incidents on campus regarding like some really horrendous language was being used, targeted at LGBTQ folks, right, as they walked around and so forth. And she started doing some research, and she saw that there were centers around the United States in colleges and universities. Some of them were called women's centers, some of them were called just gender centers. They were not directly academically based or an academic unit. You know, women and gender studies is an academic unit. So she looked around and saw that there were these kind of a gender resource center, right? And so she thought, wow, this would be really great to have at the College of Charleston because we don't have that. So coming out of that subcommittee, they, you know, proposed it to the committee as a whole, and it was approved. And Allison Pietmeyer, who was the head of Women and Gender, the director at the time, I guess they asked her if there's somebody who might be interested. She reached out to me and was like, "Whoa, okay, this sounds great."
Yeah.
And so she told me, she's like, "College, probably for the first year, what you're going to be doing is going around just meeting people, making connections, and having lots of fun. Because you're trying to kind of find out from people in terms of like how they might be able to work with you, yeah, collaborate with you, trying to find out from different audiences what are the kinds of things that they would want to see happening in a center." Mm-hmm. Like that, I had 2 interns also from Women and Gender Studies, and they were helping me do research on like women and gender resource centers around, and getting a better sense, because mm-hmm. I had to familiarize myself,
yeah,
with what are these centers around the United States. And then slowly we've been actually been doing things. You know, we just had our meeting, our planning meeting for 2018-2019, and you know, we're gonna be doing some stuff. I don't know, we're gonna get into trouble for some of the stuff, but we'll be doing some stuff.
I think that's it. Kind of wrapped it up. Yeah.
Thank you.
Answered
thank
all
you.
Of our questions without us even asking some of those.
Right? Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, that wasn't bad.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming.